From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Though Lane has weakened to a Category 2 hurricane, it's creating widespread flooding on the big island of Hawaii. Up to 3 feet of rain has fallen over the past 2 days. The island's largest population and tourist center, Honolulu, is bracing for arrival tonight. The latest forecast and update on preparations right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCalGas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you have a wonderful weekend planned, and we're going to bring you up to date with what's going on in Southern California and in the West during this hour. Later on, we'll debate a California bill that would legalize selling food cooked in home kitchens. Now, plenty of those sales are already going on under the radar of public health officials. Would it be better to legalize the practice, or would that compromise food safety and public health? But first, the big island of Hawaii's getting hammered by Hurricane Lane. Up to 3 feet of rain has fallen in some parts of the east side of the island. Meanwhile, the major population and tourist center of Honolulu is preparing for heavy rain, runoff, and storm surge tonight. With us to talk about the latest forecast for the Hawaiian Islands, meteorologist with the National Weather Service, Brooke Bingaman. Thank you for being with us, Brooke.
You're welcome.
So describe for us, if you would, the projected path of Lane right now.
So the center of Hurricane Lane right now is about 180 miles south of Honolulu, and it is still forecast to move northward towards Oahu, Maui, Kauai. And then by the time we get into Saturday afternoon into the early morning hours of Sunday, we're forecasting that the storm will weaken and make a westward turn.
And at this point, does it appear that it will directly, the eye is going to hit anywhere on the islands, or instead the outer bands of the hurricane?
Well, right now with the forecast, we have the center staying to the south of the islands, but we have, many people have seen this graphic, the cone of uncertainty. And that cone does bump up into the islands. So there is still the possibility that the center could come very close to the islands and potentially make landfall. So we don't want residents to let their guard down, because we can still have a stronger impact from the hurricane.
Many of the hotels, particularly at Waikiki, but elsewhere on the islands, have shallow beaches in front of them. What's the predicted storm surge from Lane, and what effect might that have on those hotels?
Yeah, what's happening with the ocean, we have a very dangerous, life-threatening situation, because it, you know, the full moon is out, or not right now because it's daytime, but the full moon will create the high tides. And so high tides alone are going to be at 2.5 feet higher than normal. And then on top of that, we have storm surge of 3 to 5 feet.
Ooh.
And when you consider that the waves are actually breaking, you know, what does that mean for the surf? The surf could be anywhere from 15 to 25 feet, potentially higher.
Oh, my goodness. So almost certainly you're looking at flooding to occur with homes along the beach and with hotels as well. Now, if it actually ends up that the center of the hurricane ends up making landfall along the islands, what will we be talking about there with the effect of the storm?
Yeah, so right now, our main concerns are the waves as well as the flooding and the rain. The winds, however, will be even more of an impact if the eye comes closer to the islands, because that's where the strongest winds are. So right now, we have the forecast for tropical storm force winds up to hurricane force winds. But like I said, the eye is where the strongest winds are, so the closer it gets to the islands, the more impact and damaging winds will have.
It had been a Category 4. It's now a Category 2. Is there much hope that in the next 12 hours it'll further weaken and that it'll lessen the damage to the islands?
Well, yes, we're still forecasting it to weaken. But again, there's still a lot of moisture. Even if the winds weaken so that the category reduces, we're still going to have all that moisture. And since it's been, the hurricane has been spinning so long in the ocean and moving slowly, we're still going to get those high waves. So the threat of flooding and waves is still very real. And then how strong the effect of winds is, that'll again determine on how close it gets to the islands.
We're talking with meteorologist with the National Weather Service, Brooke Bingaman, joining us from Honolulu, where she's providing up-to-the-minute forecasts on Hurricane Lane. As we mentioned earlier, the Big Island has already seen, particularly along its eastern coast, very, very heavy rain. And Brooke, have you been following the reports of the flooding on the Big Island?
Yes, I've seen some of the footage of some of the damage. We've heard of multiple road closures from landslides. We've heard of various areas getting inundated with flooding. So I haven't kept up to date with all the latest because we've been busy getting messages from the public as well.
Well, and the Kona coast, it's been comparatively dry, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things about this approaching system. You know, it's completely hammering, you know, the east side of the Big Island, but yet the folks in Kona aren't getting that much rain. And that's because some of the winds are traveling across the Big Island and then coming down into the Kona side. And it's almost like the winds are like pushing clouds away. So it's not getting rain there.
It's so odd because the storm itself is to the west of the islands, and yet all the heavy rain is on the east side. It's funny how the system operates. You mentioned the speed of the storm and that's a significant problem. What's the rate of movement of Lane right now?
It's only moving at 5 miles per hour.
Whoa, so for it to go by the islands, it's going to take seemingly forever.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is the longer it stays in this area and it's just slowly moving towards the islands, that means the longer all of the islands have to get a lot of rainfall, the longer the waves will be building in the ocean and hitting our shores. So that's why, regardless of the track, regardless of where the center is, we're still going to get significant impact.
Brooke, thanks so much. Before I let you go, is there anything I possibly neglected to ask you that would be good for our listeners to know?
I think the main message that we want people to understand, because like you said, some places aren't seeing effects yet. So I think some people are starting to think, oh, it's not really going to hit. But the truth is, you know, we're still expecting very strong impacts to occur later today or tonight. So I want people to stay aware.
Thank you so much. Brooke Bingaman, National Weather Service meteorologist, working hard there in Honolulu. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Also with us, news director of Hawaii Public Radio, which covers all the islands, Bill Dorman, who joins us from downtown Honolulu. Bill, thank you for being with us. Just set the scene of what you're seeing in your neighborhood.
Yeah, Larry, it's actually Oahu, as Brooke was talking about, has had a very quiet morning. The sky's right now looking outside, kind of a slate gray, really. Some dark clouds are moving a bit, but the ocean is gray from where I can see. The surf is up, definitely. Not as high as it's going to get, but it's a little higher than usual. But it's relatively quiet. It's not raining here. As I say, it's overcast, and certainly the threat of worse weather to come. But right now, expectations for a lot of folks thought that they were going to wake up, with tropical storm force winds this morning. That hasn't happened, as Brooke was saying. The slowing of the storm, that slow grinding movement, really up the island chain, has meant that so far Oahu is still really more in a situation of waiting.
Have the beaches all been cleared in anticipation of the storm surge?
They have, and as late as yesterday afternoon, there were some stragglers in terms of swimmers and such, but lifeguards have been off the beaches. The lifeguard towers are not manned. And really, that's part of the broader set of preparations in terms of the city and county of Honolulu. As you said, the most populous island in the chain, about 70% of the state's population lives on Oahu. The buses stopped running last night, and they are clear today. Schools have been closed yesterday and today as well. The streets, I'm just looking down on streets that at this hour, a little after 7 in the morning, would usually be busy, are pretty clear, near empty. You've got a few cars, but not a lot of movement. So it's really, again, that anticipation, that slowdown, and really waiting for what Lane is going to do next.
It's got to be eerie for you, Bill, because you're not seeing high winds yet. It sounds like the surf is up, but you're not seeing a massive storm surge. You're not seeing significant rain, and yet it's everybody's laying low. It's got to be a very strange thing to observe.
It's true. That's certainly true here in Honolulu, as you mentioned, in terms of elsewhere in the state. The east side of the Big Island has been getting hammered absolutely over the past 48 hours with heavy rain and the pace of rain. You know, they talk about rain as much as 2 inches an hour. That intensity, and that's not just the rain itself, but the more that you get with that, it saturates the ground, and that leads to further flooding on top of that. And so that's an issue on Big Island. It's going to be more as it moves up the east side of Maui as well. And as you mentioned, even though the storm, if you look at a graphic map, the storm is moving on the left side, a lot of these impacts on the rain bands are hitting the east side of islands, and this is, again, in terms of windward coasts of islands, these are the folks that are used to getting the brunt of storms, of tropical storms, certainly, and of heavy rain during this season, not to this extent.
I'm thinking of Hana, for example, on Maui, and all the creeks and everything that come down there, and that narrow road, between Hana and the more populous parts of the island, and it's prone to slides anyway, I know, and you've got many areas there where you are on Oahu, where you've got, tributaries that I would think would be at high risk of flooding. What, off the top of your head, are there particular neighborhoods that you think would be particularly at risk on Oahu?
Well, I think you hit it with that the vulnerability aspect of you mentioned the Hana Highway, which, and there are a number of roads that have been closed as precautionary moves. There have been others at this point on neighbor islands that have been closed by mudslides, by landslides, by movement across the roads itself. Here on Oahu, as elsewhere, one of the factors that you would look at is in terms of streams. What is vulnerable to overflowing with streams? For example, one of the situations overnight in Hilo on the east side of the Big Island, the Wailuku River just overflowed its banks, and that there's a residential area right in that spot. And they were hit very hard by that. And I think as you go through island by island, looking at those streams, looking at if there is debris in stream beds, that's one thing that city and county officials before in the days leading up to this were trying to be very vigilant about, clearing out stream beds to minimize that chance of flooding. But again, the more that you have in terms of the rain to saturate the ground, that then complicates the flooding issue as well.
We're talking with Hawaii Public Radio News Director Bill Dorman, joining us from downtown Honolulu, where he lives, and he's able to look out and get a view of what's happening in the heart of the city as well as out to the ocean. Those hotels, particularly along Waikiki, very shallow beach there, do you know what's going on in terms of occupancy? Are there a lot of tourists who weren't able to get out, who are battening down the hatches there? And do you know what's going on to prepare those hotels for the surge?
Yeah, definitely. We sent actually reporters out yesterday and into the late afternoon in Waikiki to wander around, talk to folks and see what's going on. On any given day across the islands, the Tourism Authority here figures that about 270 comes to the hotels and the visitor industry more generally. Structurally, the hotels are very sound. As you say, in terms of the coast there, looking at the waves, possible storm surge, that's going to be a concern. It's going to be a concern, frankly, more longer term with beach erosion as an issue, which has been an issue for all of our islands, but in particular spots. On the short term for tourist safety, again, a lot of folks are here. Some were surprised by the fact that the storm is approaching. But again, you have the rains and the issues of the rains, and then you have the winds. And as Brooke was telling you earlier, you know, the higher winds are a risk on their own in sort of a different category than the flooding and the rains. But at this point, I think the hotel folks, the tourism authority folks, are confident that they're going to be able to handle what comes, and they're prepared to just sort of shut things down and keep visitors inside the hotels if the storm comes close and until it passes.
Bill, all of us in Southern California send the best to your listeners and residents of all the islands there in Hawaii as you prepare for this. What's clearly going to be, whatever happens, a trying circumstance within the next 12 hours or so. We're thinking about you and wish you all the best. Thank you for taking this time on what's such a busy day for you.
Appreciate it, Larry. Aloha.
All right. Aloha. News Director, Hawaii Public Radio, Bill Dorman with us. Coming up on Air Talk, the future of food sold from home kitchens in California. It's a misdemeanor now to sell food you make at home. Should California legalize it? We'll talk about the trade-offs back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up on Film Week, review of all the week's new movies. And we'll also look at nudity on film with the Me Too hashtag movement. Is that changing the way that Hollywood goes about casting actors for nude scenes and the ways in which filmmakers respect the privacy and concerns of actors? That comes up later on Film Week, our second hour here on KPCC. Right now, we'll talk about a bill in Sacramento which would take a very common practice, people selling food that they've made in their home kitchens, and legalizing that instead of it being a misdemeanor to sell food that you have cooked at home. With us is Oakland farmer and member of the COOK, or Cook Alliance, an advocacy group supporting the bill, Brandy Mack. Ms. Mack, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So share with us what you think the advantages would be of legalizing this practice.
There's several different advantages. One is everybody start cooking in their home. So we get to go back to home, something that's missing out in our bustling city world where we're passing each other in the night like strangers. The other piece is a stimulus of our economic system, providing a micro small enterprise for families that are now in danger. Let's just face it. The food scene people are selling out of their houses now, but illegally, and they don't know it. So some of the fear that people have around, oh my God, people are going to cook in their home. This is so unsafe. Unfortunately, we know and have data that proves that people actually get food poisoning from restaurants more likely than they would in anyone's home kitchen. So not only is this going to be something to support less danger of food poisoning, it's going to stimulate the market for micro industry, small, and let's just face it, African-American, brown and black women and immigrant people in our country.
What sorts of inspection standards would and permitting process is a part of this bill?
Same, similar to that of a restaurant. Well, we're working closely with public health to come out and certify the kitchen that the cook is cooking in their home. So there will only be allowed to be two folks that will run the kitchen inside of the home. So this is not a business that can be taken and people can hire people and there's 20 people cooking out of your kitchen. This is a small micro industry that will work closely with public health and community to support.
And what would be the frequency of inspection of the home kitchen?
So we're looking at an initial inspection
And then I believe that every 90-day to 120-day inspection with public health.
All right. And how would that be paid for? Would the home cook be purchasing a permit?
Absolutely. So this is stimulating all around. This is a win-win. Our home cook would pay for a permit. They would have to get the same certifications as those needed to cook in a kitchen, a culinary kitchen. So there'll also be some stimulating education around food safety for each of the home cooks.
We're talking with Brandy Mack, who's an advocate for AB 626, which would legalize and regulate the selling of food cooked in home kitchens. She's board member of the Cook or COOK Alliance and a farmer in Oakland. Also with us from UC Davis, food safety specialist emerita, a professor, certified food scientist focused on consumer behavior, Christine Brune. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you.
What are your concerns about allowing the sale of food produced at home?
Well, I think the purpose is quite laudable. I think we would all embrace the idea of allowing people with special abilities, unique recipes that they are preparing to share these with the public and to do so in a safe manner. It's great for them to provide, to be able to begin an industry. But I'm concerned that although there's some good features to this bill, I'm concerned about the various things that are prohibited or severely restricted. I'm pleased to see that the bill does require the owner of the establishment to pass the food safety test that provides training on safe handling. But I'm very concerned that there are no requirements other than having a sink and hot and cold water as to washing and cleaning, washing both the person's hands, the facility, the dishwasher. I'm concerned that the local officials are prohibited from adding any additional food safety issues. The copy of the bill I see indicates that the facilities can be inspected no more than once a year, and that any other time the inspector wants to come by, they have to document the reason why they're coming in, and it can only come if it looks like people have gotten sick already. So I think that they need to rethink and strengthen some of these food safety provisions so that it's both feasible for the small individual with great recipes and skills and a desire, and safely protects the public.
One of the issues that I see time and again when you read the newspaper accounts of restaurant closures is the holding food at unsafe temperatures, either the food not being hot enough or sitting out too long or not being refrigerated at all or at a cold enough temperature. Is that a challenge in your view, Christine Brune, in the home kitchen?
You know, absolutely. We have done research here through the university and various grants where we've gone into people's homes and asked if we could videotape them as they prepare food. And we both take, with their permission, we put a thermometer in their refrigerator. And when they declare their food fully cooked, we temperature that also to see if it's met the recommended requirements. And we find regretfully, that many times these requirements are not met. Often people think their refrigerator is cold enough, but it is much warmer than the recommended 40 degrees Fahrenheit or less. We found some people's refrigerator as high as 60 degrees.
Wow.
We find that when people are cooking the food, unless they use a thermometer, they do not bring it up to the recommended temperature. With chicken preparation, we found as many as half of the people declared their poultry done before it had reached the required 165 for poultry temperature. So just saying that we're doing it at home and therefore we feel good about it and wholesome about it, people need to follow the regulations and they need to have more space. I mean, look at a home refrigerator. How are you going to have food for up to, I think they say no more than 30 meals? How are you going to have food for all these space in your refrigerator for all of these extra meals if you only have a home environment, you've got to pull that up.
You could require that, right? That if people are going to be producing those amount of meals, that they have to have refrigerator space to handle that, right?
As I read the bill that was sent to me this morning, you can require nothing more than what's currently in this bill. I didn't see anything about required refrigerator space. So, you know, I think the concept is great, but there needs to be some fine tuning to enhance the safety. We don't want people becoming ill from eating that great home-prepared, tasty recipe.
UC Davis Professor Emerita, Food Safety Specialist Christine Brune with us, and Brandy Mack, a farmer based in Oakland, board member of the COOK Alliance, which is advocating passage of AB 626, which would legalize the selling of meals prepared in home kitchens. I'd like to hear from you what you think about this, given what you're hearing about the bill. Do you feel like the safeguards are sufficient, and do you feel like it would balance the interests of entrepreneurs who'd be able to sell from their kitchens, people who want to enjoy the meals that are prepared in someone's kitchen, and the public safety concerns too. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Brandy Mack, what about the bill, according to Christine Brune, not having specific requirements for refrigerator space for number of meals prepared, nor for having more than an annual inspection?
Well, I think the bill has an amendment. Maybe I don't know what copy you're looking at. And I absolutely agree with her on the idea of working closely with public health, which is what we've done throughout the creation of this bill. And if you'll notice that we're limiting the amount of sales, so not the traditional amount of sales, so all requirements and things shift. When we're not looking at this massive, capitalist, humongous, let's sell for 1,000 people to come into our restaurant. So that's going to change the amount of safety and public health that's needed, because we're not looking at feeding the masses. This is very small micro industries where the food is moving at a quicker, faster pace, where these businesses are not 8-hour businesses that are staying open. These are mostly one-shot events and people feeding community. So I understand definitely the concern of, like, well, they don't have to have a required refrigerator. And I think we actually added an amendment of support. In fact, one of our supporters, the Refridge Group, who's supporting us on this bill, is in support of looking at how do we create community refrigeration to support deals like this.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brandy Mack, also, what about the research Christine Brune has done at UC Davis showing that even when people knew they had a camera on them and they were only making smaller quantity meals, they still, in many cases, failed to meet safe food practices?
Well, that's a moral dilemma that I think we all deal with. And one of the things that having a micro, know who your farmer is, know who your cook is, then we're actually going to have a chance to combat that with the idea of having home cooks. You get to meet the cook and walk into their kitchen. I'd like to ask our community, how often have you walked behind the kitchen inside of a restaurant to see what was happening? There's actually a little bit more accountability with a home cook versus a restaurant, because we don't know what's going on behind that counter.
So you're saying with a home cook, you might know the person, you might go into their kitchen, see it for yourself in a way you wouldn't in a restaurant?
Absolutely. I began engaging in this policy because I worked with a group, Josephine.com, that's provided a platform for home cooks. And I was a home cook. I'm also, again, as an urban farmer and director of the Butterfly Movement. We work with young African-American girls and women, and we build urban farms to help support the rites of passage of these women. And it's really hard getting funding, in particular when you're looking at niche markets like myself, working with African-American women and girls and land. And so how do we raise funds? And so we had the opportunity for a while to use all the food that we were growing in our farm and prepare value-added meals to sell that allowed our program to run. Now, what happened was we were able to not only just sell and make funds, but we connected with community members who had no idea that we existed in their own community. So this was so many different levels. Instead of them going across town to get food, we met people we hadn't met before. They came to the farm. They came to our kitchen, which we contracted with the local school, so they did have.
Hey, Brandy Mack, thank you for sharing. I'm sorry I'm up against the clock here, but I really appreciate you sharing about what you're doing with that nonprofit in Oakland. Let me quickly share some listener comments. Raphael in Fullerton says, I work in enforcement in Orange County, wants to know whether the bill's going to specifically cover the manufacturing and production of food, and also cover people who might be trying to turn their homes into restaurants. Gabrielle in Sylmar says, I'm a former health inspector, and when I did my inspections, I could go in at any time, that's sounds like that's not part of this bill. That's a concern for Gabrielle in Sylmar. Samson in Silver Lake said, I think it's a good thing. In L.A., there's a huge culture of cooking on the streets and in-home kitchens. It's a good way to open up more cuisine at an affordable price in the city. And Hayden in Palm Springs says, I've worked in restaurants and bought multiple home-cooked meals as well, and I think that it's safer. I feel safer eating from a home cook than in a restaurant. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back with more right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Film Week is coming up at the top of the hour. In addition to reviewing the movies of the week, we'll also talk about how the Me Too movement is affecting nudity in film and what additional protections there are for actors who agree to do nude scenes or who might feel pressured to take their clothes off on film. But right now, we take a look at virtual reality and the retail experience. Walmart has recently filed a pair of patent applications for technology that would allow customers to shop in a digital version of the store. They'd be able to interact with merchandise through a 3D simulation. The simulations would respond to gestures and even generate sensory feedback. You might be able to feel moisture, heat, a force, or wind. But it's not just Walmart. Last month, Amazon introduced virtual reality kiosks in malls in India. The question is, what is the future for this? Is this potentially just 3D television that comes and goes? Or might this be the dominant way that we end up shopping when we're not hands-on in a brick-and-mortar store? Joining us is Jeremy Bailenson, founding director of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us.
Larry, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What do you think is the realistic potential for this kind of shopping experience?
So the first I talked to Walmart about this, Greg Foran, the CEO of Walmart North America, and the C-suite team came to my lab. And, Larry, I gave them demos of just about everything you can do in VR. I showed them how you can do communication, do training, how you can touch and feel things with haptic devices, and just to kind of give them the overall feel of what VR is. And I got to tell you, Walmart is really innovating in this space. They're really thinking ahead, and just what you outlined, which is imagine, among other things, being in a store and getting to pick up objects, getting to try on clothes so that it folds over your body in the right way. It's a, you know, some people love going to shopping malls. I tend not to be one of those people, and the idea of being able to beam into a store and to get what you want and to beam back out, it's just a really big idea.
And, you know, with VR itself, it seems one of the challenges is the hardware, the cost of the device, the size of the device. Do you think that there is an economical and less burdensome way that people will be able to experience this?
So here's the big news flash, which most people don't know. Walmart, so I've co-founded a company, it's called Striver. Walmart has worked with Striver and has trained over 200,000 employees in the past year, where the employee puts on goggles, she looks around, she practices things like holiday rush, talking to customers, and for the past year, 200,000 people have used these devices. So we've already figured out how to get these devices at scale into the hands of people, and it's stunning how well the hardware works these days. That, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, and it used to be the goggles cost hundreds of thousands of dollars when you have all the tracking equipment. We're putting them in stores now for, you know, less than $100, and they work.
Well, and it seems like the holy grail would be if you could have a smartphone that provides all of this. You just slide it into a device, you know, some framework or something, so it's quick and easy at your fingertips. That would be ideal. Is that possible?
So that we're actually close to there now, and that system, that solution has some challenges because your phone can ring, your phone does 20 other things. What's actually emerging is something called standalone systems, which is really cheap hardware. If you think about a phone, you can get a phone for pretty cheap, and it's got pretty good displays and good sound, but all that it does is VR, so there's no, you know, mess, no fuss. You just strap it on, and it works perfectly. So it's actually the phone systems are what we've been using with Walmart, but now when we're going to train people in stores, we've switch to these standalone systems like Oculus Go because they just work out of the box.
We're talking with Jeremy Baylinson, Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, and I welcome your calls for our two guests on this topic of virtual reality and the shopping experience. Questions at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us from UCLA's Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior, neuroscientist Don Vaughn. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how do you think this might affect consumer behavior? Would it make people less likely to buy, more likely to buy?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, one of the big points about virtual reality that's been a struggle is making it feel real. I mean, virtual reality really is a brain hack. It's tricking your brain into thinking that you're in a place experiencing objects that you're actually not. So, you know, as you know, Professor Baylinson pointed out, there's been a lot of progress in that lately, but I'm a little bit bearish on it in the near-term future. I think what Walmart and Amazon are doing is a long-term play, and these things are going to work out, but it really takes the right amount of sensory feedback in just the right way to make it a completely convincing experience. And we haven't seen it yet in retail. We've really seen that VR has been, so far, much more of a gimmick where people will, brick-and-mortar stores use VR headsets and devices to attract people to their store because, as it stands, VR delivers a fantastic visual experience now, but a lot of the general ambiance and experience you'd get from walking into a store, which is a lot of the reason people buy products, it's not just the product itself, it's having the experience and the salesperson and the clerks and getting feedback and advice and really feeling what it's like to try on that suit or that sweater. And so while I think this, there's no question, and Professor Baylinson really made it clear that this is the future. It will be what people do. I just want to be careful that it's probably several years out before we see massive changes in the market. And that's really backed by Goldman Sachs did a study on this, and they projected that in 2025, this retail market for VR is going to be about $1.6 billion. And just to put that in perspective, that's about a thousandth of what Amazon is worth now.
Let's talk a little bit more about the barrier that you described, because it seems you're describing a very sophisticated way that our brains and bodies working together experience the totality of the environment, that there's so much going on. Mm-hmm. It makes it at this point impossible for virtual reality to recreate all those inputs. Is it folly to think that technology could reach the level of sophistication to create such an immersive experience, your brain is really fooled?
It makes you wonder if we're in the Matrix now. I mean, there's no reason a priori that we would think this isn't possible. I mean, over the last 20 years, I remember looking at a VR headset from 15 years ago. You put it on, and within 3 minutes, I was completely nauseated because there was a 50 millisecond delay, but a 20th of a second between when you did something and the feedback that you got. And your brain is smart. It's evolved for 7 million years to experience the world in a particular way. And when that's wrong, you know immediately. And so, as I said, you know, and again, as Dr. Baylinson said, those limitations have really started to become a thing of the past in a lot of these senses, but I'm just not seeing yet that it's completely immersive in the way that it needs to be. So just as one example, when you go to a store, there's all this social feedback between, you know, when you say something, the facial recognition on a salesperson, and we're so wired to expect that. And only this year have really Oculus and Magic Leap started to do facial tracking with EMG and cameras and put that on your avatar so you can have a real social VR experience. So that's just happening now. It'll make a big difference.
Well, and as someone who works in radio, not surprising I'd say this, but the auditory experience too, because we pick on so many unofficial things, just sort of background noise, people talking. You know, if you can't recreate that sort of just organic sound, which doesn't directly relate to the experience, I wonder how real it's going to feel. We'll get back to Jeremy Baylinson, professor at Stanford University, the founding director of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, and Don Vaughn, Semmel Institute for Neuroscience at UCLA, where he's neuroscientist. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Back in just 1 minute. Just a few minutes away on Film Week, our critics review the action comedy The Happy Time Murders, which pairs puppets with live action actors like Melissa McCarthy. We'll find out whether that was a good idea or not. The Happy Time Murders coming up. Jim Henson's son, Brian Henson, is the director of the film. Right now, we're talking about virtual reality and the consumer shopping experience. Walmart and Amazon both jumping into this in a big way, believing that the technology will allow buyers a much more immersive experience and from remote locations to really have a sense of what it's like shopping in a brick-and-mortar store. We're talking about the potential in it as well as the challenges in recreating a real experience. Let me go back to Jeremy Baylinson, Stanford University. How do you think you overcome the challenges that Professor Vaughn was talking about?
Yeah, so these are great points, and totally agree that this is not happening, you know, this holiday season. We've got a little bit of time before it's worth putting on the goggles to go into a virtual store as opposed to ordering online. And actually, let me isolate two particular challenges that are things that I've been thinking about for quite some time. So what do I need to go to a store to actually touch and feel in order to know I want this product? So one example is clothes. You want to try them on. Another example is something like fruit, because you want to pick it up and squeeze it and make sure that it's ripe. And, you know, right now, VR is simply not good enough so that I can put on a shirt, look in a virtual mirror, and see how it's going to fold over my body in particular ways and really get an actual sense on how it's going to feel. You have seen some applications, for example, you can try on glasses, because glasses is not something that forms to your face as in a difficult manner with computer graphics. Mm-hmm. And so where I think what you're going to see an evolution for is there's going to be some products where it's actually worth putting on the goggles, seeing what it looks like, and I don't have to drive to the mall. But that's not going to be everything, and it's not going to be for every person. So totally agree this is a long-term play. And for many products, just simply seeing a 2D image on a screen is, you know, I can buy toothpaste that way. I don't need to be in VR to buy toothpaste.
Yeah. Susie in Bell Canyon, good to have you with us.
Hi. I have a friend who's actually an expert in simulation software who is currently working on a product that is a low-cost in-your-home device that can scan a person's body in the privacy of their home and then actually take a pattern for a piece of clothing, a 3D piece of clothing, fit it to the body, and show you as you move around in real time how it would fit on your body realistically with folds and, you know, exactly how it would line up. The simulation goes on the virtual body that you create with this software that exactly fits your body. And my friend that's working on this is actually working to partner with clothing manufacturers to get this software into the hands of consumers.
It's fascinating because, of course, you know, in dentistry now, they use those scans. If you're going to have a crown put, I just had this done, where they do the scan of the mouth. There's no more of the goop in your mouth. And it's so exacting that then they just make the crown and put it on from there. So Don Vaughn, UCLA Semmel Institute, it makes sense to you that when it comes something like fit, they'll really be able to master this.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very interesting how you phrased it, because one of the strong points of VR is really visual rendering. It's come a long way in the last 25 years in looking at something and having it look pretty real. And so I think we're going to see a huge change, and this speaks to Amazon's new patent too, about being able to try on clothes and see them on a virtual figurine of you and see how it looks. I would just say that that's very distinct from trying on the jacket and realizing that it fits right or is too tight in the chest and isn't right. And this is probably
or feeling the fabric.
Exactly.
Because for a lot of people, that the texture is a big deal.
It matters a lot when you go and buy. There's a reason that Amazon's return policy is so generous.
Susie, appreciate your call. Kevin in Torrance, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks. I'm an industrial designer, and I primarily build and model in 3D and output to CNC or rapid prototyping. And I've been using VR for model evaluation before you go to cut expensive, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar molds or go into production. And what I've seen a difference between like an Oculus headset where you're just moving your head around sitting in a chair and like an HTC Vive where you're up and you're walking around through space with the headset on. And when you move through space and you're crouching down and looking up, your brain buys off a lot more on the proportions. So if I want to evaluate a body kit that I've made on a car, if you can get up and walk around it, brain buys off on the realism, just registering the proportions in space and how big things are. And I think that'll help with retail rather than just sitting in a chair with a cell phone with a holder strapped onto your head, having a headset that you can walk and move through space. My concern is that using this myself in my work, it's a really tight focal length and you can't spend a lot of time in there or you're going to ruin your eyes. So as on all these usages for VR, we're going to ruin our eyes. We're going to need a different technology than this short little focal length inside of a helmet or a visor.
Kevin, I really appreciate your call. Jeremy Bailenson of Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. You want to speak to the vision issue?
Yeah, so let me address both those issues. And the point is right on, which is if you summarize, you know, we've published a couple hundred papers now that put people in VR and examine how they learn, how they can innovate, how they understand a space. And if we were to try to, you know, isolate the single biggest predictor of how effective a simulation was, you don't even need machine learning. You can simply correlate the amount of body movement, the amount somebody walks around, if they're moving their hands. Moving in VR actually predicts how effective the simulation will be and what you learn. So completely agree, and the data supports your intuition there, which is that if you're walking around, you're updating your field of view in ways that the perceptual mechanisms cause you to learn more, and we know this fairly robustly. On the vision side, I'd be careful with the language there. There's not data that shows time spent in VR hurts your eyes in any long-term way. Now, that being said, I'm hugely conservative on VR use. In my lab, we've got a 20-minute rule, which is after 20 minutes, take it off. And it turns out most often people don't need to go back. You know, if you're talking about design decisions that you're making from prototyping, you don't need to walk around that thing for 20 minutes. You build it in your CAD file, and then you pop on that helmet, you check it out, you walk around. And there's great data on this. There's an amazing woman named Elizabeth Barron from Ford, and she's been prototyping cars in VR for quite some time. And, you know, I spend a lot of time with her kind of thinking about this. And 5 minutes is enough. You don't need to spend hours in there getting dizzy. You just kind of check out whether this part fits in a certain way and see what it looks like from a different angle, and then you can pop it out. So agreed that we should keep it to a minimum and avoid eye strain, but I also want to be careful. There isn't data yet that shows that it hurts your eyes in any meaningful way, just to make sure we're not being alarmist.
All right, Professor Vaughn, we're tight on time, but I want to ask you, what Kevin's raising is this really interesting brain-body connection that in movement, your brain buys it. Why is that?
Yeah, so it's exactly how we were designed, which is you need to be able to see an object from multiple different perspectives to really understand it. And it's a phenomenon called parallax. When you move back and forth, the object changes and you have stereo vision, and then you can make a 3D model of it in your head. These 2D models just don't work. And so it really is important to have this experiential component where you can walk around, especially when objects are a little more distant. And so, you know, if you move, a mountain doesn't move much in the background, but the car in front of you might. So you really can get a sense of the proportions of that car fundamentally and intuitively and not just from a picture.
Hey, you two gentlemen should take this on the road. This is fascinating. And in fact, I'm putting you on the spot, but could we reconvene in a few months and talk more? There's so much more to get into, and probably in 6 months there'll be more developments for us to take on. You game for that, Professor Bailenson?
I'm only game if you come up to the lab when we stick the goggles on you.
All right. I'll try and make my way up there to Stanford. Thanks. And Don Vaughn, Semmel Institute, UCLA, thank you so much.
Great to be here, Larry.
We appreciate it. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Film Week is next.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. A solar water heating system doesn't replace your existing natural gas water heater. Instead, it helps by preheating the water with the warmth of the sun to help you use less energy. When you install a system at your home, you'll still have the hot water your family relies on for baths, showers, and laundry. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover nearly half the system's cost. It's the strength of the sun in your home. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I'm joined by film critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick, and Tim Cogshell, critic for Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com. We start with the action comedy The Happy Time Murders. It combines a puppet cast with a live-action cast headed by Melissa McCarthy and Bill Beretta. They're detectives in modern-day Los Angeles, living in a world where puppets and humans coexist.
Looks like a robbery gone wrong to me.
This wasn't a robbery. This was a hit.
Welcome!
Someone out there is killing puppets.
Jim and Jane Henson of Muppet fame parented Brian Henson, who directs this film. Todd Berger is the screenwriter. The Happy Time Murders, we should mention, despite having puppets, is rated R. Tim?
Yeah, you know, this movie does pull off an interesting thing. This movie is literally never good. Never. It's always bad. Always
There's
bad.
There's not a single funny...
Ah, but that's the interesting thing. It's very often funny. It's terrible, this movie. Just terrible. But sometimes it just makes you laugh. And you laugh, and then you stop, and you think to myself, this is just all terrible. This is just really... And then you laugh again. And what's going on in the movie? The puppets are being killed by someone. And this puppet is joined with his old partner, Melissa McCarthy. There's a thing that drove them apart, and he was the first puppet to ever be a part of the police department. Now, the underlying theme of this film is sort of interesting. What it's kind of doing is sort of playing with contemporary race notions, most of which I think are sort of like related to the African-American community. The puppets bleach themselves. They're treated very badly, hassled by the police. All of this, these sort of notions are going on. They're sort of like second-class citizens puppets. And someone has taken it upon themselves to actually start killing them, and that's what these guys have to stop. And it's always terrible.
It is always terrible, and I would say it's funny one time. There's exactly one sight gag that made me laugh out loud. But the rest of the time, I was just like, how does this thing exist beyond just the nugget of an idea? And the nugget of an idea isn't even novel because we've seen naughty puppets. You know, if you look at Avenue Q.
Avenue Q is brilliant.
Right. Or Team America World Police with marionettes. Like the idea of these puppets doing totally inappropriate things, although they look like Sesame Street characters, was novel a long time ago. And they just, it's puppets having sex and puppets doing drugs and puppets in porn movies and puppets in hot tubs drinking with sexy ladies. And like, that's it. That's the idea of it. And yet at the same time, as Tim says, it's meant to be this allegory about racism. And it's also meant to be sort of a modern day film noir because the puppet detective is like washed up, hard boiled, disgraced detective who's now a PI. And, you know, it's sort of shot and it has the beats and it has the characters of a film noir. This femme fatale comes into his office with an assignment for him. And it shifts gears really jarringly between being raunchy and trying to shock us and trying to be wildly hilarious and then trying to say something and trying to have moments of remorse and possible redemption for this detective character. And the human beings in it, I mean, I guess they're game for whatever. It's Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph and Elizabeth Banks, and they're all wildly talented comic actresses, and they're down for whatever comes their way. But I just was bored.
Where I found that other funny actually was mostly with Maya Rudolph. Who plays his secretary. And most of it are just in her sight gags when she takes that bottle of Windex out when all that business is going on and off.
Don't
just
ask.
Just sight gags. Just all the things she does with her.
Yeah,
the way
her talent, yeah. Independent of the film.
Yeah, the way she chews that gum, it just makes me giggle. And so anyway, yeah, no, not good.
Happy Time Murders, I don't know if you two are aware, is currently 22% on Rotten Tomatoes. Vanity Fair's review says the Happy Time Murders may be the worst movie of the year.
No. Because just last week, we said the same thing about that Kevin Spacey movie. I think it only made like 120
million. Millionaire Boys Club. I would say that Gaudi is worse. What makes this not the worst, and you see it during the closing credits, is that there's actual craft at work here with the puppet work. And you see behind-the-scenes stuff during the credits, and it makes you realize, oh, people with actual talent and ability contributed their talents and abilities to this. And so you appreciate the work that goes in behind it, but the result is terrible.
The Happy Time Murders action comedy, rated R. It's in wide release. The Mystery Searching stars John Cho. Anish Chaganti is the director and co-screenwriter of the film. Christy, what'd you think?
This is really good, although it is predicated on a central gimmick, which we've seen a couple of times before. The film takes place entirely within a laptop or various electronic devices.
Always a screen.
Right. There's a screen, and John Cho is quite often, you know, in close-up on half of that screen. He plays a father, a widower. He has a 16-year-old daughter, played by Michelle Law, who is a pretty conscientious young lady, but one night does not come home after study group. And he begins this search for her, and along the way realizes that perhaps he did not know her as well as he thought he did. And so it's like a lot of movies about technology in that it's meant to be kind of simultaneously an embrace and an indictment of the possibilities of technology, because, you know, it's supposed to bring people together, but here it kind of keeps them apart. It allows her to create a secret life for herself, but also he needs the technology to track her down, and he's very methodical in the way he does that, between FaceTime calls and text messages and going through her Facebook. He has to, like, reverse engineer it to figure out her password, to figure out, you know, who her friends are, and makes a spreadsheet of all her friends and who last saw her where and when. It is gripping, and you are all along with him the entire way, every step that he takes in trying to figure out where she is. John Cho is great in this, and he's so versatile. He was so great last year in Columbus. He can really do anything. But for here, he's on the screen quite often acting opposite nothing and no one, and it's just him reacting to the information that he gets, and there's just nowhere to hide, and he really makes you feel everything that he is feeling. This kind of loses its way eventually, because in time there is information he has that would make him omniscient. Like, there's information that he gets that, you know, along the way we're seeing things that he sees, and that all makes sense. And then all of a sudden there's surveillance video.
Yeah.
And that was frustrating to me, that it deviates from its central purpose here.
It kind of goes Columbo on you. And it starts explaining things, because, you know what, this movie needs to be over. It's 88 minutes long. We've got to get out of here now. But John Cho is so good in this movie. That's the thing that I say that this movie has to offer. And the young lady that plays his daughter is also quite good.
Is that Michelle Law?
Michelle
Law.
Very good, yeah. And he just holds it down. I mean, it's almost like watching a guy working on a stage doing this stuff as he looks in that camera and goes through these emotions. And I love that he does a lot of it without speaking aloud, without brightly enough. Very often with these films, they will just have a guy talking to himself. You know, he's looking at the thing and saying stuff out loud. No, all in the eyes, and then we have to read. We follow that cursor around as it points to things on the screen. So you got to pay attention. If you're going to do something like this, do it like that. Bring the person into it and give them a reason. What he's basically doing, what they are basically doing, is they're making you him. It's like you're looking for your daughter. And then they do a really smart thing. The technology, which is generally speaking distancing, it is the technology that tells him who his daughter is. His daughter is on that computer, not in his life. He finds out who his daughter is by looking through her computer.
Searching is the mystery. John Cho, Michelle Law star, Anish Chaganti, the director and co-screenwriter. It's at the Arclight Hollywood, the AMC Century City, Arclight Sherman Oaks, and the Century Huntington Beach. It's rated PG-13. The comedy Support the Girls stars Regina Hall, Haley Lou Richardson, James LeGros, Shana McHale, and it's written and directed by Andrew Bajalski. Christy?
I love this movie. This is one of my favorite movies of the summer, and it looks like one kind of movie, and it is something very different and much more poignant and much more significant and relatable. So it takes place at this sports bar that's kind of like a Hooters and kind of like a TGI Fridays along the highway outside of Houston. Generic looking place with big screen TVs and giant beer and young waitresses dressed in itty bitty uniforms. And it takes place all throughout the course of a single day where Regina Hall, who is phenomenal in this. This is the best work she has ever done. She finally gets a chance to star in something and really show off all she can do. She stars as the general manager of this restaurant. And it's how she navigates the highs and lows and the drama, big and small, of everything that happens during the day with the waitresses, with the customers, with her own personal life interfering in the middle of all of that. And she has to figure out who she needs to be in each situation to either get what she needs or make that person feel better or just diffuse the drama of the situation. And she feels like a mother hen to these young ladies. And they're all lovely. From the outside of it, it looks like this is a raunchy kind of 80s sort of screwball sex comedy. It is not. It is about a woman surviving and trying to figure out who she wants to be, who she has to be, and who she wants to be. And I loved it. The ending is so powerful. And it really, it's like a Shaggy hang, this whole movie. And then the ending is just a primal scream.
Shaggy. That's a very good, very because it is very Shaggy. I have been calling it messy. But Shaggy, I think it's better. It's more Shaggy than messy. Because you're in this movie, and it is sort of floating around all over the place. You're following Regina, and very often you're literally following her. The camera is like right over her shoulder as you walk with her around this place, and you deal with each one of these people one by. And she's like their big sister. She's like their mom. She's like their parole officer. And they're just these women who are working at this place. And she's got the kids that she's got their kids she's taking care of, and then she's got this boss. James LaGrosse plays this
boss. He's horrible.
And this movie is very clever in the way that it reveals things. For instance, you find out in this very subtle way that he is the son of the person who started that place and that he inherited it. And that makes you feel a certain way about him right there. Right there you have. And you like him in that he is perfectly honest about what a big A he is. He is that guy, and he's going to be that guy. There's a sports event that's supposed to happen over the course of this thing, and the television goes out.
It's a fight. It's a boxing match.
And that is just the most hysterical dynamic. Every young woman in this movie is a movie star. All of them. All of them are movie stars. Every time you look at one of them, they got you. And I hope to see them all again starring in their own movies. They're just all wonderful.
Haley Lee Richardson is always good in everything. I mentioned Columbus with John Cho a minute ago. She's also in that. She's great in that. Mm-hmm. But Shayna McHale.
Oh, my gosh.
This is her first film, and she's like the voice of reason, and she's hilarious. Andrew Bujalski, who wrote and directed this, comes from the mumblecore, quote-unquote, genre, which is a word I hate and doesn't really exist anymore. But Mark Duplass came from that, and Greta Gerwig came from that. And there is an understatement and an intimacy in the stories he tells, and he uses that here to tell a bigger thematic story, and I loved it. Please go see it.
Support the girls. Support the film, according to Christy. It's rated R at the Newhart Theater in West Los Angeles. AXL Axel, a top secret robotic dog who develops a friendship with a young man. Alex Neustetter stars in the film. Oliver Daly is the screenwriter. The film about this top secret robotic dog and a Bond.
Somebody spent a lot of money on him. They gotta be looking for him.
I don't think his owner deserves to get him back.
AXL Axel, what did you think of it, Tim?
This movie is a boy and his dog movie, and it hits all of the beats of a boy and his dog movie. This happens to be a boy and his robotic dog movie that was built by a super genius scientist for the United States government to be a war dog and kill people. But nevertheless, it's a boy and his dog movie. And we have this young man. He's one of those dirt bike guys. And, you know, he has his father's played by Thomas Jane, who looks great, by the way, in this movie. And they're kind of on the poor side, trying to make this dirt bike scene. And he ends up with this sort of nemesis, rich family, Ted C. McGinley playing the dad on the other side over there. A lot of fun. Haven't seen him in a while. And, you know, they have their issues, and there's a girl in between. The boy runs across this robotic dog, and you know, the story develops the way that you would think. The super scientist who's working on that government contract, he wants his top secret war dog back. So he's got all these drones that are flying around looking for his dog. Here's the thing about this movie. It has one really centrally dumb thing in it. This dog, this super dog, is gas powered. It runs on gasoline. High-octane gasoline. This has just got to be the dumbest thing. I cannot believe the people who wrote this script, no one gave a note. We should probably put a battery in the dog or something like that. Nobody. Oh, it's a gas-powered dog, as you can conceive.
Make him solar-powered.
This becomes a problem eventually in the movie.
All right. AXL Axel, the sci-fi film written and directed by Oliver Daly. It's rated PG. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the British drama The Bookshop, Crime and Punishment, a documentary, and Papillon, the remake of the film that was so popular back in the 1970s. Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, and we return in just 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire, our critics this week. Next up, the British film The Bookshop, starring Emily Mortimer, Patricia Clarkson, Bill Nighy. It's written and directed by Isabel Cosset. What did you think, Christy?
This is an extremely British film. This is
You have to do the review with a British accent.
Nobody wants that. I promise you, none of our listeners want that. So Emily Mortimer is a widow in 1959 in this sweet little British seaside town. And she wants to open a bookshop in this old, abandoned, historic house along the main street in this sweet little town. And it's the one thing that she and her husband love. They love reading together. And so she wants to honor that. And so she begins to fill the bookshop with books. And people are excited about it, I guess, except for Patricia Clarkson, who is like the queen bee in town and the arts doyen. And she wants to use that building as an art center to make it like her fiefdom, the center of her societal realm. And she basically fights Emily Mortimer for the bookshop. And that's it.
That's the film.
Yeah, basically, the theme of it is like thinking for yourself is good and reading books is good. And it's pretty safe and pat. Having said that, from a production standpoint, it's quite lovely. It gets all the details right, like down to the little tea kettle cozies. And you can feel the dampness in this old building and you know, all the little school kids and their little knee socks. Like it's very vivid, the picture that Isabel Cosset paints here. But it's just, there's no tension. There are no stakes, no tension.
Yeah, so Tim, how did you see it?
Move quite differently. Set in 1959, in Fahrenheit 451,
right.
Ray
Bradbury,
Lolita,
right.
All of these sort of controversial books are sort of at play. Bill Nighy being his brilliant set. This is the thing that's brilliant about this movie to me, which I was deeply and dearly moved by.
Wow.
Is it begins so light, so funny, almost quirky when we meet all of these characters. And by turn, it becomes a much more serious and dramatic movie. Such that by the time you get to the end of this movie, it drew a tear out of me when she gets on that bus.
Now, you saw the same film, right?
it became something more akin to Remains of the Day in terms of tone and timbre when we get towards some of that really interesting thing. Bill Nighy is this fellow who's living off in this house all by himself, and all he does is read these books, and there are all kinds of stories about why and what happened and why he never leaves the house and whatnot. And then he strikes up this relationship with Emily Mortimer's character. And it's just these wonderful, wonderful moments of where he does that thing that he does, Bill Nighy, the way that he can take 14 seconds to say one word, and she knows to simply let the camera linger on him, twitching and tingling it's just so sweet and wonderful. And you're right about that look. I mean, there's no place that actually looks like this. I don't believe there's any place that actually looks like it's so clean and beautiful, and these people are so witty.
It's very charming.
That little girl
who helps her in the bookshop.
That little knowing girl who says everything that other people won't say, and she just says them aloud. I love all that stuff.
Else says things out loud is our narrator, Julie Christie, because the bookshop is based on a book called The Bookshop, and Julie Christie is reading a lot of chunks and holding our hand and spelling things out for us quite a bit. I agree that Emily Mortimer and Bill Nye have really nice chemistry with each other. And Emily Mortimer is great in everything. What she's doing here is very understated, but there's not much to her character beyond being she's feisty and she likes books.
Yeah, she's planting seeds.
That is about it. But it's sweet. It's a sweet, charming movie, I suppose.
Starkly different perspectives on The Bookshop, the British drama that's rated PG. It's at the Landmark in West L.A. Crime plus punishment. It's got the stylized plus sign. Maybe they call it Crime and Punishment. Documentary directed by Stephen Meng. Christie?
This is a very powerful documentary, and it shines a light on a topic that happens probably not just in New York City among the police there, but probably everywhere. And the whole topic of police brutality is unfortunately all too relevant all the time. But this takes place very specifically in New York. And it follows this group of about a dozen Black and Hispanic police officers in New York who dare to blow the whistle on this institutionalized method of forcing cops to arrest people and, you know, cite them. And there's a quota system that the police department denies having for many years. It begins around 2014, I want to say. And these police officers have audio tape and videotape of receiving marching orders from their direct superiors saying, you know, you only have X number of arrests and summonses. You need more. You need to get callers. Get out there. And it's how they're instructed to go to, you know, specifically poor Black and Latino neighborhoods in the Bronx, in Brooklyn, and find people and just arrest him for nothing.
The underlying theme of all of this has always been that there is crime in these communities and that there is no possible way for any of you people to miss your numbers because there's enough crime for all of you to make your numbers. It's just a matter of you finding the crime. The crime is there. Just go find the crime. And, of course, that will naturally lead to exactly what they're talking about in this movie. The assumption that there is crime will lead to the natural arrest of anyone that we assume is committing those crimes.
Well, one subplot that they follow through here is about a young man who is accused of murder, of a shooting in a convenience store, and he spends a year on Rikers Island before they find video that shows that somebody else did it. And so he eventually gets out, but he's lost a year of his life, you know, and the expense, too. A lot of it is the expense that the city relies upon from these arrests. And so they need the money from the arrests. And so there's pressure on the police to come up with more arrests. And you see the retaliation that these police officers suffer when they do dare to speak up, when they do complain about this method. They get, you know, terrible shifts and they get written up. And it's really powerful and really eye-opening. And also frustrating because probably this goes on a lot all the time.
Crime Plus or Crime and Punishment, the documentary, Stephen Meng, the director. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles, also streaming on Hulu. The doc is unrated. The film Papillon, a remake of the 1973 film, critically acclaimed. Charlie Hunnam stars with Rami Malek. It's directed by Michael Noor. Tim?
No.
Just blanket, no? Christy, what did you
think? No, pass.
It is an odd thing, though, because it is, you know, a beautifully made film, very professionally made film, is staged nicely, but it's flat, it is staid, it is more... it's visceral but not emotional. We can feel the pain and the time and the but I don't know. It's just a film. And then I think about Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman, and here we have Charlie Hunnam and Ron. You know, and I'm sorry, no, not even close. Just cut that out. That was just insane right off the top. But when I think about the folks who made this movie, the young man who directed it, Michael Noor, I think he was born in 1971, two years before the original movie was made. No reference there, perhaps, you know, but I was alive. I saw that movie in the theaters. And this doesn't even come close. Which is a Franklin Schaffner film, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and the screenplay, Dalton Trumbo,
Lorenzo Semple
Jr., and William Goldman worked on the script, too.
Yeah.
So.
And I'm like, just all across the board here. We're not even in the game. We're not even in the game with the talent that made that original film, and it shows.
Kind of a head-scratcher that this was a movie they thought to remake, because it's not like the old movie would be dated.
Right. And it's not like the old movie is one that needs improving upon. And so, and they did not do that here. Yeah, it's amazing that this is a dramatic story and a true dramatic story. And it's a story of bravery and hardship and real drama. And it's just so dull, you know, it's just so lifeless. Charlie Hunnam, I appreciate that he makes choices like this, though, because it would be really easy to just be hunky, right? And he works with directors who challenge him, like Guillermo del Toro, like he worked with James Gray on Lost City of Z a couple of years ago. But like Lost City of Z, he has a supporting player in here in Rami Malek. There it was Robert Pattinson, but Rami Malek kind of steals this away from him because it's a much showier role. It's twitchy and edgy, and it's always interesting, whereas as Charlie Hunnam, as Papillon, is kind of just stoic and just kind of just keeps losing weight and keeps, you know, being stoic in the face of pain and punishment. And yeah, it's kind of a drag.
It's strange. Our Wade Major mentions this to me. The French story, of course. They go to the island of French Guiana. It's never been made in French.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Despite a French title. Rami Malek, by the way, we're going to see later this year in Bohemian Rhapsody as Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
So
that's great casting.
For something completely different.
Yeah.
Papillon, the remake, is in select theaters. It's rated R. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Christy Lemire, Tim Cogshell, our critics this week. The comedy thriller Arizona, directed by Jonathan Watson, Luke Del Tredici. Chi is the screenwriter. It stars Rosemary DeWitt and Danny McBride. Tim?
Had me for a little while, and then it simply got a little too clever, I suppose, for its own good. We have this woman. She's living in Arizona. It's set during the whole sort of housing collapse, which happened there. Really, really big. All of these little McMansions all around and empty cul-de-sacs. And she is a person who bought one of those houses and is a real estate agent and is in all kinds of trouble. She has a daughter. She has an ex-husband, I think. At her office, where she's working with Seth Rogen, who is a horrible boss, something happens that involves what's his name there. And you know, after that, the movie moves off into one of those sort of you know, how much more sadistic and crazy, and how much further can we push the story? Sort of dark comedy to very, very bad things, sort of stuff like that. And I don't know, wore me out after about 15 minutes.
And it's not that much longer than 15 minutes. It's a pretty short film. It's only like 82. This is brutally violent, and it makes these very jarring tonal shifts, because you're right.
Danny McBride.
Yeah. It wants to be a dark comedy. And it wants to be a legitimate thriller. And it wants to make a statement about what our economy has suffered, what real people have suffered. 99 Homes did that too, but in a much smarter, more realistic way. Everyone is horrible in this movie. And there's really, I mean, aside from Rosemary DeWitt, but there's nobody to root for here. The director.
I think you mean terrible people. They're good acting, but terrible people.
No, the characters are all terrible. Yeah. The director, Jonathan Watson, was a longtime first AD on a lot of Danny McBride projects, like Eastbound and Down and like Vice Principals. And people like David Gordon Green, they're all buddies and they're all producers here and they're all supporting him here. It's a nice gesture to support this person with his first film, but yeah, this is brutal.
Arizona, unrated, Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, the French drama Memoir of War, written and directed by Emmanuel Finkiel. It's unrated, Christy.
So Melanie Thierry stars as a woman living in France toward the end of World War II. This is based on a memoir.
Marguerite Duras.
Marguerite Duras. Mm-hmm. And it's how she does not know whether her husband is alive or not, whether he's going to come back from Germany or not. And it's how she moves in kind of a haze through this really volatile period in Paris where it is the end of the war and people are coming home and they are having closure and they are having celebrations. And she's just like in a fog. And a lot of it is her kind of poetic inner state, her inner turmoil. And Melanie Thierry is tremendous in this, in a film that is itself a little overlong in language.
Yeah. Cold, disjointed. Her husband was in the resistance. He was captured more than once. And she is simply in the sort of turmoil of waiting even to find out that he's just plain dead. And unfortunately, that's what the movie feels like for us as we watch it. I feel like I'm in the turmoil of her waiting, but I'm not in a narrative that's taking me somewhere.
Memoir of War, unrated. The French film is at Lemley's Theaters, including the Town Center in Encino, the Royal in West L.A., the Playhouse Pasadena, and the Regal Edwards West Park. It's Film Week on KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about nudity on screen and what the actor's experience is like. During the Me Too era, have things changed around the experience of casting for films that includes nudity? And do actors have more leverage when it comes to nude scenes than they had in the past? You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire, our critics this week. They continue with us along with Tatiana Siegel, the deputy film editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Her piece just published in The Reporter, The New Politics of Hollywood Sex Scenes in the Me Too Era. And before I speak with Tatiana, I want to invite those of you listening to our Friday live program. If you're an actor, I'd like to hear your experiences about how you decide whether you'll do a nude scene or not, how you've navigated any pressures that you've faced for a film in which nudity is required, whether you've faced that from an agent, from casting people, from directors, how you've gone through that whole process, and whether you've seen any change as a result of the Me Too movement. Again, I'm asking for those of you that are actors to weigh in on this and the complex issues raised by nudity on film. 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. You can also comment on our Film Week page, or you can tweet at AirTalk with your thoughts about this. This again for the calls on our Friday live show. Tatiana, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me back, Larry.
So share with us some of the conversations that you had in preparing this piece. Are people seeing any changes in recent months?
Well, it's funny because when I started reporting this piece, I really thought that I would hear, you know, there's been a huge sea change since Me Too. And in the 10 months that have passed since Harvey Weinstein was outed for allegedly sexual assault and harassment. But what I found instead was that it's been a little bit slow to change, and there's a lot of talk, but there are still those sort of abuses that you've kind of heard about over the years, that like people get pressured to do more than they are contractually obligated to do. And it's still a problem. So what has changed is there's a lot more sort of lawyer protections being done proactively, where they will have very sort of specific nudity riders, which will have up to 40 points that'll say, you know, this can be done this way, this can be done that way, this cannot be done that way, so that there's very little ambiguity.
And one of the things that Tatiana, just I've heard from actors who've worked in productions where nudity is required, that, you know, there, if it's full nudity, there's supposed to be, you know, certain privacy guards that cover the genitals, things like that, that, you know, sometimes actors will show up and the things that are supposed to be there aren't there, and a disrespect for the performer in that case. Did you come across any of those accounts with people you spoke to?
I did not come across any like real horror stories, but I certainly have heard, you know, anecdotally from secondhand, thirdhand type of sources that these things have happened. What I heard more was like this sort of cousin of the kind of pressures that are going on anyways in the industry, that in order to move fast and in order to move like in a sort of way that keeps everything on budget, that people will sort of just on a whim sometimes like, wait, that scene is not working as is. Can you just, you know, don't wait for your lawyer to vet this. Like, we just need you to lose your shirt in this scene. And that's the, I mean, is it like nefarious, or is it just more like, We need to keep on schedule. We're on a, you know, cable TV budget, and but it's still a sort of workplace transgression.
And does it seem that this is more common with lower budget cable TV kinds of productions than in major studio films?
Well, I mean, it's what's funny about that question is there's almost no nudity anymore in a major studio film. I mean, you really have to rack your brain to think of a film other than the 50 Shades of Grey franchise that came from a major studio, was financed by a major studio that has nudity in it. Now, there might be like some version of nudity, like in The Martian, Matt Damon kind of walks across the room when he's on Mars, and you can see his butt, his naked butt, and it's probably a body double. But so that qualifies as nudity. But, you know, for the most part, there is almost no nudity in major studio films anymore. That said, yes, like as the sort of budgets go down, although look at Game of Thrones is like a very big budgeted television series, and that has tons of nudity. So it kind of varies. It's mm-hmm. not a like, oh, the cheaper it is, the more nudity you'll have kind of ratio.
Now, good point. Isn't it ironic? Television is the place you see more nudity now than major feature films. We're talking with Tatiana Siegel, deputy film editor for The Hollywood Reporter, who recently had a piece published in The Reporter, The New Politics of Hollywood Sex Scenes in the Me Too Era. And again, I'm asking actors listening to our Friday Live program, how have you navigated the decision-making process to decide that you would do a nude scene in a film or television program or not do it? What sorts of pressure have you faced? How have you dealt with that pressure? And how do you perceive it as an aspect of your business? 866-893-KPECC or our AirTalk page, Filmweek page, kpecc.org. Christy, your thoughts on this?
Well, it's funny, Tatiana mentions the 50 Shades franchise, but Dakota Johnson is the only one getting totally naked in those movies. Jamie Dornan gets to keep his jeans on in the Red Room of Pain. You know, it's not like any kind of equanimity there. I mean, when there is male full frontal nudity, it's usually in a comedy, like in Forgetting Sarah Marshall or Walk Hard. It's a joke. Yeah. This is why we need more women making these decisions, because I feel like women would look out for each other and protect each other and not allow for an environment in which women are being forced into these situations.
So you think the content of films would be made better as a result?
Yeah, well, think about how often do you really need the nudity that we see? And again, I'm not a prude, I'm not puritanical, but from a character perspective or from a narrative perspective, how often do you truly need that complete nudity, or how much of it is just pure titillation?
Or the gratuitous strip club scene that so many films, of course, have a right. part of it as well. Mm-hmm. Tim?
Yeah, all of which I love. The gratuitous nudity, the gratuitous script club scenes, all of which is perfectly fine with me in the context of whatever cinema is being made. If that's the movie you're making and you want to put that stuff in it, knock yourself out with that. And then you're gonna get the result that you get, right? So the NC-17, which came along with Henry and June, Philip Kaufman film, knocked nudity up to that and put violence in the rated R films. And that's the reason why there's not very much nudity in rated R, you know, adult movies in America anymore. Of course, this is all seen completely and totally differently in, say, Europe, French cinema, Italian cinema, where there is full frontal male nudity all the time, and lots of naked women all the time, and always have been for years and years and years. So a lot of this has to do with our perspective, our sort of, it really does have to do with our sort of American, Judeo-Christian perspective about nudity in the first place. And then comes the hypocrisy of what we do with respect to women and with respect to men. And that's where I think the problem actually is here. The boys don't get naked, but we want the girls to get naked. That's the thing that we need to eliminate. We need to examine what exactly our attitudes and perspectives are about this stuff. There is nudity in commercials in places all over the world. What are we doing here in the United States that makes this stuff so taboo? Boobies, rated R. Guy gets shot in the face, and we have a problem. I know this is a little bit off track, but I do think that the underlying question is, what are we thinking? What are our emotional requirements here?
We're at 866-893-KPECC. I look forward to hearing your input on this, particularly if you are an actor and have experienced requests or demands that you take your clothes off for a television or film production, how you've made the decision about your willingness to do it or or not? What have you thought about the context of it, the support you did or didn't get on set for the scene that you were doing? And what changes do you think, if any, need to come to the industry when it comes to actors performing unclothed? 866-893-KPCC. We'll look forward to this on our live show Friday for actors to join us with their perspectives. We'll continue our conversation with our critics, Tim and Christy, and Tatiana Siegel, deputy film editor, The Hollywood Reporter, who's written about this in a recent edition of the trade publication. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Film Week on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with our critics, Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell, and The Hollywood Reporter, deputy film editor Tatiana Siegel. Nudity in films in the era of Me Too. That's our subject. Catherine in Studio City, welcome. Please share your thoughts on this.
Yes, hi there. I've been an actor in Los Angeles for the last 15 years, and I got out here in my early 20s, have been offered many, many film auditions and roles that, you know, involved some kind of nudity or nude scene. And it was my personal choice to turn down all of those projects from the very beginning. I kind of, you know, had those come out, those auditions offered early on in my career, and I just drew the line in the sand for myself. Just thinking in terms of, like, my long-term career, how I wanted to set that up. And, you know, the only time I ever really considered it possibly is if it really served a story. I think that the actor's job is to really serve the story, but tended to be more, you know, oh, and here's a boob shot.
Did you feel like it hindered your career? Or did you get pressure from, say, an agent or someone who really tried to push you to do it?
I would say, for the most part, they were very respectful and understanding. You know, they would still send me auditions and say, would you potentially consider this, even though I had from the beginning put in a no nudity clause in my contract with them. But they would still send me things to consider, but very respectfully did not push anything that I was not comfortable with. And I have noticed, I mean, I also do a lot of commercials. I shot a really large commercial for a big brand, and they found out one of the actors had done a movie in her early 20s and had a topless scene, and they ended up cutting her and reshooting her entire portion of the commercial because of that. And so wow. It actually backfire on actors.
Wow. Catherine, thank you so much. Appreciate your sharing your experience. Catherine in Studio City. Steve in Burbank, what's your experience?
Yeah, I did a short, a feature film, an ultra low budget feature film for a friend a few years back. And I was told that I was given the writer that most actors get when they have to do nudity, but when it came to actually doing the scene on the final day of shooting, all the amenities that were said they were going to provide, including coverage of for me when I was on set, were not there because it was one of the last shots we were doing. And so I had to, because I felt like I was the smallest cog in the wheel at the time, go ahead and do the nudity without having any sort of covers for my genitals or and there was no really advocate to have on set for me. So it was really uncomfortable to be like, hey, I thought this was going to be provided for me.
Steve, I mean, it sounds like you still have some strong emotions about this.
Yeah, it was really uncomfortable. And it was a little upsetting because it was people I knew. It was deeply, it was kind of embarrassing I don't want to go through that again.
Yeah, understandably. So are you an actor now?
I still am an actor, yeah.
And so has this bad experience changed how you approach potential roles?
I certainly would involve I did not involve my agent as much in this because it was an ultra low budget, because it was for a friend and everything like that. I didn't involve him in the process of filming and all this and going over the contracts. In the future, I would definitely have called him, and then I would have, when things weren't provided, I would have called him on set. And so
Steve, thank you so much. Really appreciate your sharing that experience. Tatiana Siegel of The Hollywood Reporter, your thoughts about these first couple of calls?
I think that they sound somewhat common, at least what I've heard anecdotally. And what is interesting is the idea of like not really involving the agents. I heard that time and time again, where, you know, some sort of transgression happened on set. You know, somebody was pressured to do more than they agreed to do or whatever. And sometimes they just don't call their agent for whatever reason. And I think in the case we just heard about, it was more because he felt this was a friend that he was working with. But I think in some cases, it's like shame, like, why did I do that? Like, I really didn't have to do that. And that sort of like perpetuates the problem. It's like you kind of get victimized once and then you sort of re-victimize yourself by not then taking some action and maybe getting the scene deleted or, you know, fighting it in some way.
Well, and actors don't want to be seen as difficult, right?
Exactly. And especially female actresses, because difficult is sort of one of those buzzwords that is rarely used about men and more frequently used about actresses, although I'm sure there's a different word and it's escaping me right now that actors are called. But yes, I mean, female actresses, there's always that also that perception that if you're not willing to, there's 100 people in line waiting to do this role. So and I think that sort of causes more pressure, the nature of just how competitive the industry is.
All right. Let's talk with Ezra in Hollywood. You're on Film Week.
Hi, did you say Ezra? That part beeped out. Is that?
Yeah, Ezra, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I really great conversation. I have to say, I was talking to someone earlier. It's like it always boils. I'm a professional actor for the last 20 years in Hollywood with over 60 films and 50 TV shows. It depends always, no matter what the choice, if it's a wardrobe choice, a prosthetic makeup choice, a lint, a talk, or whatever, if it applies to the character and it brings light to the character and helps serve a non-gratuitous version of the director's vision, I'm all in for it. Because it is honestly my job to, as an actor, to communicate with an audience, to propel the director's vision, and to express myself to the best possible ability. So I'm all for nudity in film, and I wish we were more like Europe, Frank.
All right. Thank you, Ezra. Good to have you with us for another actor's perspective on this. You can share your comments on the Air Talk Film Week page at kpecc.org. Let me come back to you, Christy. Your thoughts about whether Me Too is going to change the sexual content we see in films?
It's such a good question. And it seems like slowly that might happen eventually. Yeah, but it's the machinery of Hollywood is giant and slow to turn. And I guess the logic is there's always going to be an audience of people who want to see beautiful women who are naked. And they don't want to necessarily know that those women behind the scenes are also being pressured. You know, they can see the results on the screen and they can say, oh, it's just a movie, no big deal. But they maybe don't want to acknowledge what happens behind the scenes. And that will be a hard thing to change minds on.
Tatiana Siegel, what's your sense of how producers are looking at this process of requiring nudity or the audition process? Do they seem to be a bit more cautious about their approach?
Absolutely. I think that's the one thing that has changed post Me Too is that it's being asked for less. And that's a convergence of reasons. It's not just Me Too and sort of like the possibility of having, you know, some sort of miscommunication where somebody feels like threatened or whatever. But it's also, you know, China will not let in movies that have nudity. So the major studios are making movies for China, essentially, or at least with China very much in mind. And if that's going to rule you out, you're not going to see nudity in major motion pictures.
Tatiana, I'm sorry that I have to break off there, but thank you so much. Deputy film editor for The Hollywood Reporter, Tatiana Siegel, her piece, which we link to on our Film Week page, The New Politics of Hollywood Sex Scenes in the Me Too Era. Thanks, as always, to our terrific critics, Tim Cogshell and Christy Lemire. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week here on 89.3 KPECC.